I don't believe that Tulsa has the right to say that your freedom of assembly expires at 11 o'clock. And that's why I volunteer for civil disobedience. I was arrested the second night.
I was one of the 10 that were arrested and pepper sprayed.
A total of 13 of us stood out there on the grass, and the police were coming up behind us. And I remember I was just thinking, okay, this is it.
As jazzed as I am to be thrown into the back of a police van, it's not about a personal thrill or personal fulfillment. It's about making sure that everybody knows this is a matter that's worth fighting for.
On one side would be freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and the other side would be the city's right to enforce the curfew. It's a law that the city put in place to keep the riffraff out of parks after hours. My name is Brian Horton. I'm a second-year law student. I go to law school. What we're going to do is file for an injunction. The injunction is to get the police to stop enforcing the curfew, saying that the right to protest, the right of free speech, is higher than the city's right to enforce the curfew.
To publicly gather and protest, express your grievances, is the most important thing in our society. If we don't have that ability, it's very difficult to make those grievances known, to make the true critical mass behind those protests known. That's where the power to change is drawn from, and that's why it's in the First Amendment.
Amendments to the Constitution of the United States of America.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion,
or prohibiting the free exercise thereof,
or abridging the freedom of speech,
or of the press,
or the right of the people peaceably
to assemble.
To assemble.
To assemble.
To assemble.
Do you know what assembly means?
Not really.
Not really?
That's what we've been doing. Peacefully assembling.
The right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
My name is Frank Grove.
My name is Anastasia Harlan.
I'm Marshall.
My name is Minnow Shrout.
I'm Minnow's mom. I'm Jerry McCaslin.
My name is Shannon Gus.
I'm Stephanie
I'm
Lewis.
Samantha Pritchett.
I'm Daniel Lee.
And I'm a member of
Occupy Tulsa.
Occupy Tulsa.
And, of course, the greater Occupy Wall Street movement.
The Occupy Wall Street movement has been up and down in the 24/7 news cycle, a hungry beast always prowling for the next headline. Word of mouth keeps its eyes out for stories that are interesting, counterintuitive, many of which come from the world of science. It's part of our mission to find the underreported, the simmering, the surprising ideas that make us think, what? But that demand for fascinating findings may be part of the problem, perhaps pressuring researchers to manipulate their data, even to make it snazzier. The recent scandal involving outright fabrications by social psychologist Diedrich Stoppel has raised questions of whether the system encourages transgressions. Christopher Shea recently wrote about dubious research practices for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and he's joining us today to illustrate the difference between the fudging and the nudging of the data. Christopher, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you.
Okay, so we're guilty. You know, the eye-catching, the bewildering results. We look for these kind of things that may be part of the problem. Are they?
Well, that was one reason I did the story, because I write about these kinds of studies. And when I read some of the criticisms of them, I wondered if I was, in fact, part of the problem. We're somewhat reliant on social scientists to police themselves, and we take the findings at face value, as I guess we have to. But it gets a little unnerving when someone says, "Well, actually, these findings may be the result of nudges or fudges," as you put it.
Diedrich Stoppel allegedly made up his data out of thin air. Now, you write about these much more subtle methods of influencing results and cite one study involving the Beatles. Can you tell us just about that study briefly?
Sure. Well, I mean, first of all, I think Stopples did more than allegedly made it up.
Yes, he did.
He just flat out made it up. But yeah, there have been a couple of interesting recent articles in psychology journals. It should be said that they're voicing criticisms of themselves in their own journals, which is a good thing. But the researchers first demonstrated something kind of standard. They had people listen to a children's song, and afterwards, these people reported that they felt older. Listening to that kind of song, listening to a kid's song made you feel older. Not so surprising.
Mm-hmm.
Then they had people listen to the Beatles' When I'm 64, referring obviously to, if not old age, older age, and people felt younger. Then they took it a step further and actually proved, proved statistically that the people had actually gotten younger when they listened to this song. And their point was that you could play by the rules, by the statistical rules, and come up with an obviously false finding. And they offered they explained how they did it, and then they offered some suggestions for how to avoid this kind of thing.
You call it the odds of statistical bogosity grow.
Right.
When they don't actually have to report all the ways that they presented their data. But is there a spectrum here, Christopher? I mean, do you think that researchers that work the data to sound sexier are the same? Can we equate it with those who eventually falsify things entirely?
Well, that was the inspiration for the article I wrote were some comments by another Dutch psychologist, Erik Jan Wagenmakers, and he did make that striking comparison. He was saying that there was this guy Stoppel was an outright fraud, but then he said there wasn't much of a difference between making up your data and torturing your data, which was kind of an inflammatory charge and probably overstated. I think these other more moderate criticisms are just saying that there's a combination of things, just that a subtle desire. Well, people want their experiments to work out. Mm-hmm. You don't want to spend all this time and discover nothing. And that impetus plus enough freedom to look at the data in all sorts of different ways and probe it and look for connections, and then not to explain all of that probing and exploration when you finally write up the study, that leads to problems. I think the phrase that one of these papers used was researcher freedom of, I don't know, maybe just researcher freedom.
Mm-hmm.
If you get a lot of time and the more comparisons you make basically in a big data set and the more you look for connections, the more likely you are to find random connections. And that's okay if you then either confirm that stuff or explain everything, all the probing you did. If you write it up as if you just did a narrow study and found this one thing, that's when problems arise.
Right. And there are bigger questions here of, getting headlines often leads to getting investors, getting funding, getting grants, getting a lot of attention. Do publications and journals agree that the press attention is perhaps influencing results?
They don't. I talked to the editors of a couple of the more prominent journals and journals that had published some of this flashy stuff and that had published Stoppel. And they say that just it doesn't, the amount of press attention you get is just not at all a factor in whether they decide to publish. I heard somewhat different things talking to some younger researchers who say that there's pressure in general. There's pressure to get published, and it's kind of natural. If your research gets picked up by the New York Times, you know, that gets noticed. The university public relations office notices it. It goes on the website of your blog, I mean, of your department. Yeah, I mean, maybe it does have an effect.
Well, with just a minute left, of course, social science research is not the only thing that gets picked up very quickly. Medical research, it seems like any new weight loss, anti-aging study gets just as much, if not more, media attention. Is that field potentially as guilty of researching for headlines?
Yeah, I think one complaint that psychologists had about my story was that I focused, one, too much on social psychology because of this Stoppel fraud, and too much on psychology in general, when these are basic statistical problems. Every social science field faces them to one extent or another, and these debates have also been raging in biomedicine. There's a Stanford statistician who's gone so far as to say that 50% of all medical research is wrong, and he makes he's got methodological complaints about how people are analyzing connections between genes and disease or
Christopher
treatment.
I'm so sorry I have to pull you off right there. We've out of time.
Sure.
But I really want to thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Christopher Shea blogs for the Wall Street Journal. You can find more on the article at wordofmouthradio.org.